Hey guys, welcome to episode 11 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I have Sharla Nicely and Jeff Bell. They've both done a lot for OCD. They both continue to do a lot for OCD. And recently, they've joined ventures to create beyondthedoubt.com. I had a wonderful conversation with them. We touched on many areas, but we also brought in one of my other passions, which is personal development. They're both of that mindset of bringing personal development, self-development, philosophy, looking at ways you can take self-ownership and being better and applying these principles to therapies like ERP and CBT. And I think it's such a wonderful attitude, and I think it's one a lot more therapists can adopt and help their patients adopt, is this kind of can-do attitude. See what you think. I think you enjoyed this episode. I'm also riding 100 miles for OCD UK. Riding is in cycling on July the 31st of this year. I'm going to try and update you best I can on my coverage, on my training, and how I'm getting along. I did my first training ride today. It was incredibly hard, especially when I hit the hills. It's going to be an adventure. I'm proud to support the charity OCD UK. If you can support me anyway, there'll be a link on the site, but just your kind of moral support would be enough. I hope you enjoy this episode, and I'll see you soon.
In today's episode of the OCD Stories podcast, I have Jeff Bow and Sharla Nicely. Jeff is the author of When in Doubt, Make Belief and Rewind, Replay, Repeat. He's also a radio news anchor in San Francisco and a public speaker on OCD. Sharla is an anxiety disorders treatment specialist in Atlanta and author of the forthcoming book, Is Fred in the Refrigerator? Together, they co-founded beyondthedoubt.com. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thanks for having us.
No, it's a pleasure. It was John Hirschfield that led me on to you guys. So thanks to him. I always start the podcast with, you know, getting people's personal OCD stories if they have one. And then, you know, you guys can tie in, Lucy, what you're doing now. We'll go into that more. It'd be good to find out more about your OCD backgrounds.
Sure. So,
you want me to go first?
Yeah, you go first.
Okay, so I've probably had OCD all my life, but didn't really know that I had it. I knew there was something wrong with me, clearly, from the things that I would do, but I kept everything secret because my OCD told me that if I ever told anybody what was going on, then I would make all those bad things happen. That's what I call rule number one. I had to follow rule number one. Yeah. And so I ended up finding out at about age 26 that I had OCD. Just randomly, because the therapist I was seeing at the time, because I was sort of miserable just in general, I happened to let slip that I really liked the number four and how wonderful four is. And she thought that was a little odd and managed to pry a couple things out of me because I kept all this OCD stuff to myself. I wasn't even going to tell my therapist about this stuff. Yeah. So this was like, you know, for her pulling teeth. Finally got that out of me, diagnosed me with OCD, but didn't know what to do about it. Sent me to a psychiatrist. They put me on a pretty high dose of medicine pretty quickly. I had some bad side effects, didn't work very well, and thought, okay, I'm just not going to do that. Tried then, it's when I knew what it was, I tried over the next probably decade on and off to get treatment and had everything except ERP pretty much, and nothing worked.
Yeah.
And finally, I had an episode one night where it just got so depressing and so awful that I kicked a hole in a wall in the kitchen. It was awesome. And managed to actually call a friend and tell her that I was really suffering. And she really suggested I try to go back to a psychiatrist and get some medicine. So I did do that and was able to be on the medicine for a long time until I had some random side effects that are sort of rare on SSRIs and I had to get off of it. So it's this sort of on and off thing with not exactly figuring out how I'm going to manage this. And finally, I decided, well, I must be doing the best I can. I should really, you know, put my thoughts about OCD down on paper because I'm actually doing pretty well considering all this stuff that I'm dealing with. So I decided, well, I should probably research OCD and figure out a little bit more about it before I start writing this book. So I look online, which I'd never done before, and found the International OCD Foundation. And this is where my cat is going to probably come in.
Hello, Milo.
This is Milo.
Hi, Milo.
Wants to be a star. Down on the ground. Thank you. So found the International OCD Foundation. They were having a conference in a couple of weeks. I went to it And the very first session I went to, they talked about the gold standard treatment for OCD being ERP. Yeah. And I spent the whole conference with my mouth hanging open and realizing that, oh my gosh, there was something that would fix this thing. And was so blown away by ERP, by learning about it. I started doing it that day on the way home from the conference for myself. I came back. I signed up to take a master's program in counseling. Right after I came back from the conference, I decided that this was working so well. And it was so crazy that I hadn't been able to find anybody to do this for me. That obviously we needed more of these people. So I was just going to quit my job and go back to school and become a counselor. And so that's what I did. And then I decided as part of my recovery, I really needed to break rule number one, the best that I could. So the best way I could think to do that was to put myself up for the keynote for the IOCDF.
Yeah.
So a couple of years after I'd been to the conference for the first time, I auditioned, so to speak, sent in a video about to do the keynote, was chosen. And that's how I met Jeff, because he was going to interview me as part of the keynote. So that's where our paths crossed. And I'll let you take it from there in terms of our story together, but I'll let you obviously tell your story first.
Sure. So, let's see, we're going back a whole bunch of years now as I'm getting up there in age. So 40, 45 years ago, we really didn't have OCD as part of our vernacular. And my folks had no framework for describing or understanding what I was going through. And so the running joke in our house was Jeff gets worried when he has nothing to worry about. I was a classic worrier, but for me, this was largely mental compulsions. I would rewind, replay, and repeat in my head the most mundane sequences in my day. And I was, without knowing it at the time, trying to find some certainty where it didn't exist. So my earliest childhood memories are what I now know to be OCD checking, mental checking. But my high school and college years were essentially symptom-free. Life was really good. And then in my late 20s, things started spiraling out of control. The first episode I remember was in my late 20s. A friend of mine had bought some tickets to a 49ers football playoff game. And I was so excited about this. And I parked the car quite a distance away because I was too cheap to pay for the close parking. And as I'm walking to the football game, the thought pops into my mind that maybe I hadn't set the parking brake. And I remember thinking at the time, what a bizarre thought. There was no reason, no precedent that should have prompted that thought. But it became increasingly disturbing as I walked to the stadium. And at some point, this voice of doubt, as I came to call it, suggested that I'll never be able to enjoy the game if I don't go back and verify that I set the parking brake. So I did. I turned around, walked back to the car. I saw that the parking brake was set. I momentarily felt better and started walking back to the stadium. I think you know where this is going. Yeah. About halfway back there, that same voice of doubt suggested that maybe I look through the window, but that wasn't enough. I should go back there and actually check the parking brake. So to make a long story somewhat less long, I missed the entire first quarter of that 49ers playoff game, and I had no idea what was going on. It was sort of the genesis of my physical checking that would come and start spiraling out of control for years and years. So I started checking parking brakes and windows and doors and appliances and everything that I said, everything that I did. And I had no idea what was going on. Of course, one of the cruel twists with OCD is that we're acutely and painfully aware of how ridiculous the thoughts are and our responses to them. So I became quite depressed during this process as well. And then the somewhat comical arc to my story is that I was living a very public life at this time. I've been very fortunate to have a successful radio career. And so day after day, I would go in and talk to a quarter million people on the radio. And that was the easy part of my day. Getting to the studio was becoming increasingly difficult. And as part of my job, I was tasked with getting into a news van and driving out to the scene of breaking news stories and telling the Bay Area what was going on, the flood, the fire, the crime of some kind. And the irony here is that I fairly quickly in the evolution of my OCD developed hit and run OCD. So anytime I was in a car, the fear would be that each pothole I ran over was actually evidence of a body I had run over. So I would start turning the car around and going back and checking to make sure that I hadn't run somebody over. And so, whereas I was being paid to efficiently get out to the scene of a breaking news story and tell the story, I was instead driving the well-marked KCBS We're Everywhere news van. Actually, KCBS were driving in circles around the Embarcadero, which is the area that we were in. And so things got so crazy that I ultimately started taking taxi cabs out to breaking news stories. And life just continued to spiral and spiral and spiral in more difficult directions. And ultimately, I knew I needed help, but I was so fixated on what would happen if anybody found out that I was seeing a psychologist. I mean, the stigma around that, that I wound up spending a lot of money out of my own pocket to avoid leaving a paper trail. And I sought treatment in the wrong places. And the first doctor that I saw, I call him Dr. X in my book, was very quick to put a box around me. After three or four sessions, he looked at me and he said, "You have a fear of success, don't you?" And I'm thinking to myself, as psychiatric hangups go, that's a pretty noble one. So, yes, doc, that's it. And needless to say, that was not the correct answer. And so I went on my way and I tried to soldier on for a while. And I went to see a second psychologist I call Dr. Y. And Dr. Y, who I have affectionately dubbed Dr. How Does That Make You Feel, was a classic psychotherapist who, regardless of what I would tell her about my OCD, would lean across the couch and say, "Well, how does that make you feel?" And so I did this dance with her for month after month, and nothing was working to get my OCD better. Then ultimately, Dr. Y stumbled across a treatment process that worked. She took vacation because while she was on vacation, my inner investigative reporter took over. I was fortunate to find a book in a local bookstore called The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Watching, Dr. Judith Rapoport. And something about the words couldn't stop really spoke to me. And I read the first story in that book, which was about a guy driving down the freeway, convinced that he was leaving dead bodies behind him, then turning his car around. And I swear to you, my first thought was, I don't remember writing a book. It was that uncanny that somebody else was describing something that I knew so intimately and so painfully. From there, I was able to connect with the International OCD Foundation, the same organization that changed Shala's life. And a very helpful woman at the other end of the phone line walked me through some treatment options in my area. And I was able to get into the care of an OCD specialist to help me start turning my life around.
Yeah, that's excellent. They're both obviously fascinating stories. And so Charlotte, you said you had it. I remember, sorry, yesterday I watched your talk, 2013 talk on the International OCD Foundation. So that was about 4 years old. You think it sort of started to kick off, and then so yeah, that mine was sort of 6 or 7. And then Jeff, how old were you? Did you say it was you were in college or left college?
Yeah, so my first bout with OCD, the childhood OCD bout, started when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, okay.
And for whatever reason, the OCD sort of went away for my high school and college years. And then in my late 20s, the adult onset OCD kicked in with a vengeance.
Yeah, no, I found that actually. Mine went away. I say went away. I can't really pin too much anxiety around the age of 19 and sort of 23. I know I still had some quirks, but it wasn't really causing me any trouble. Which is weird. I think sometimes when there's more upset in your life, you're potentially prone for it to come back. Which I think my life was very stable from 19 to 23. But yeah, it's just an observation. So other than we'll get into ERP in a bit, because I know you guys have some great advice. Have a cat's back.
Milo has some thoughts here.
He really does have some thoughts about this.
So yeah, well, you guys have got some good advice on ERP because I was on your webinar the other day, which is really good. But I always try and get out whether there's any other tricks or tactics anyone does or any other therapies to help them recover. So I guess other than ERP and CBT, have you guys made any sort of lifestyle changes? Have tried any other therapies? Therapies around OCD, it's not necessarily talking therapy, because we know that doesn't necessarily work.
Yeah, I think we're, I was gonna say, I think we're both big fans of mindfulness as kind of a layer to put on the ERP, the CBT.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm a huge fan of self-compassion. I learned about that through a Brené Brown e-course that I took a couple years ago, and it was really eye-opening to me when she talked about self-compassion and had us take a self-compassion assessment. It was so eye-opening that you could be self-compassionate, because that was not how I treated myself. I treated myself like my OCD treated me. Real, I was really mean. And so that's been, I think, a really helpful adjunct to the ERP, because the more self-compassionate I am, I think my OCD becomes less powerful.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. Brené Brown's awesome. I only know her from her TED Talks, and I read one of her books actually, but yeah, no, she's great. I absolutely agree with the self-compassion part. I think we're all so tough on ourselves, and you obviously, if you're tough on yourself, it's hard to recover. If you start loving yourself and showing compassion, you're going to have more motivation to continue VRP or mindfulness or whatever it is. Cool. Did you guys, have you tried any sort of dietary changes or anything like that?
I find that, taking care of the physical side certainly makes a difference. I mean, certainly not someone who's changed diet or exercise in a major way, but I definitely find that my stress correlates with my health or lack thereof.
I agree completely. And so I try to exercise. It doesn't happen every day, but try. Sleep's a big thing for me. If I'm tired, I'm much more likely to have OCD. In fact, when I kicked the hole through the wall, I was really tired. I think you saw in the story somebody had called and woken me up in the middle of the night. Just not a good plan. So yeah, it's really important for me to get enough sleep.
She says that after I just took a red eye out to Atlanta last night.
That's
3 hours sleep, and so if I start doing compulsions, you'll know it's just a matter of my lack of sleep.
We'll forgive you. No, I absolutely agree. I'm terrible at getting enough sleep. But yeah, I definitely notice I have more anxiety on days where I'm tired. Or any days I can get agitated, and usually because of lack of sleep, and then someone irritates me, and then that would just set something off. Okay, cool. So in the webinars on, you guys, I loved the approach of the webinar. For the last 10 years, I've been heavily interested in personal development. I've got so many books like through there, all kind of personal development philosophy along those lines. And I found you're obviously bringing an ERP, which is a therapy, but the overall core of it was very much a personal development theme. And I like bringing in these types of ideas into treatment of OCD. I always touch on the success mindset, which is a positive psychology term, but it's very much a personal development term of someone with a success mindset will look for the opportunities, and someone with a fixed mindset, they'll find the obstacles and they give up. And I noticed that people who do ERP, you can tell if they have a successful fixed mindset and how far they go in ERP. So you touched on a few subjects of that. One in particular was Viktor Frankl, you talked about, and his book Man's Search for Meaning, which is incredible. And you talk about the importance of meaning, and I think purpose was the other one. I guess if you could just explain that concept for the listeners, because I think it was really beneficial.
What might be helpful is if I kind of walk you quickly through the aha moment in my life that led to my great breakthrough in the power of purpose and meaning and
Yeah,
how I
absolutely.
discovered Viktor Frankl and so forth. So in 1997, I was at my wit's end. I had been through five therapists. I had been on and off various medications. I had read every book that I could get my hands on for personal development and the OCD treatment and everything. And I was really bitter because no one or nothing could fix me. And that was my mindset. No one or nothing could fix me. It wasn't about what I wasn't doing. It was about what others couldn't do to wave a magic wand and make my OCD go away. And one hot, sticky August night in Northern California, I found myself in my backyard hammock. And I remember the scene so clearly. I've thought about it so much over the years. I'm staring up at the mighty heavens overhead. I'm in this bad place, my pity party years, bitter about everything. And I remember blurting out to no one or nothing in particular, "Show me how to turn around this crazy life, and I'll share my story with anyone who will listen." It was like this taunting bargain I was making with the universe. And remember thinking at the time, well, that was kind of weird. Where'd that come from? And I waited around for a couple of days, and the little instruction book did not come drifting down from the mighty heavens. But something profound did happen. I turned that bargain on its head, and I thought to myself, I'm in a good position to tell a story about getting better from OCD. I work in radio. I'm comfortable in front of people. I like telling stories. I like kitty cats when they walk across the screen.
Again.
And I thought, I'm in a great place to tell a story about getting better from OCD, and that's what I'm going to do. Only one small problem. I have no success story to share. And so I turned that bargain on its head, and I did the proverbial put the cart before the horse sort of thing and said, I'm going to get better so I can tell a story about success and help people. And with the benefit of hindsight, I now realize that what I did is identified for myself what I've come to call a greater good goal. And when Charlotte and I talk about greater good, we talk about purpose and service being incredible motivators, almost opposite sides of an empowerment coin, if you will. Purpose empowering yourself, service empowering others. And what I learned experientially is that we are motivated like no other way through purpose, through service, through giving meaning to our life, which is where I discovered Viktor Frankl and his incredible work about the value of meaning and the drive that that provides for us in our lives. So from that moment, I spent a year journaling, putting down on little 3x5 cards that I neatly stacked all over my house, all my obsessions, all my compulsions, all the triumphs, all the setbacks. And then I spent another year stringing those cards together into a really bad first draft of a book. And then 9 more years writing and rewriting and checking and rechecking that manuscript. And then ultimately, I was able to have the opportunity to publish the book and start sharing the message. And what I learned was, yeah, it makes a huge difference. The more I got out there and started giving meaning to what I'd been through, and being of service to other people with OCD, the stronger I got. And that led to my second book and actually my work with Shala today through Beyond the Doubt, which is just taking this notion that we truly help ourselves by helping others, and that purpose and service are incredible motivators to do the hard work of ERP. And that's, I think, where you and I started intersecting when you were using some of these tools and finding that to be the case.
No, that's really good. That's an incredible story. I always find those, there's so many of those stories that your aha moment where you kind of look to the heavens, so to speak, and said, you know, if you just do this, I'll do this. And I think, I guess, on a side note, a more philosophical note, it's kind of interesting that there's something going on, whether that's God or the universe or some kind of energy, but something's happening. I think that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, we'd like you here to hear anyone say that, because we are big believers in Albert Einstein's notion that the most important decision we'll ever make is whether or not we choose to see the universe as friendly. And we think there's so much power in that, because the choice itself, from that choice, everything else follows.
And I think that especially when you have OCD, life can be so bleak and dreary, and it's hard to see the good in anything. And the other Einstein quote that we like that goes along with that is, there are only two ways that you can look at life. One is as if everything is a miracle, and the other is as if nothing is a miracle. And we like that mindset of everything's a miracle, and Even these really hard things that we've been through, you can find purpose and service and meaning in all of that, and move forward and make a positive difference.
Yeah, one of the things that Shala has really helped me understand, because so much of this just evolved experientially. I mean, it's like, okay, I learned that this works and let's run with this, is that OCD really paints very dark images of an unfriendly universe. And it's so easy to get sucked into that, right? And we think that the whole world is out to get us, and that, you know, we have to. It ultimately leads to a distinct lack of belief in ourselves and others and in life. It's the doubting disease. It's called a doubting disease for a reason. It strips away that core constructive belief in our own inherent value and in the value of others. And so, yeah, it's made a big difference when we've been able to kind of shift our thinking that, yep, hey, we can't prove it one way or the other, so we're going to go ahead and say we choose to believe the universe is friendly and allow ourselves to be driven by that.
And I think one of the big aha moments for me, and one of the reasons Jeff and I started working together, was when I read his second book and understood the concept of the universe is friendly. And this is, I think, the fourth time, which, you know, my OCD is really happy about, because it really likes four. When I read his book and had this concept of the universe is friendly, I had never thought of the world like that before. And I was really hypervigilant all the time, even though I'd been through exposure therapy. I was a whole lot better in terms of obsessions and compulsions. I still sort of felt like I was walking around tense all the time. So I was just waiting for that next thing to happen. And when I was introduced to this idea that we actually can choose to see the world in a different way, even if that's not what our OCD believes, to me, that's the ultimate exposure that has helped me get better, is to choose, regardless of what my OCD wants to tell me, to see that the universe is a friendly place and that I don't have to walk around scared that all these bad things are going to happen, and to act as if that content that bad things are going to happen is irrelevant. So go out and have a good life and enjoy things, because that's what life is about, even though OCD doesn't want you to do that. And so that's when I started communicating with Jeff and saying, my gosh, this idea revolutionary, it sort of changed my life, and I started buying books from him for my clients, and that's how we started hooked up and decided to do Beyond the Doubt.
No, that's awesome. I agree with everything both of you have just said. I don't know if I can add anything to that, but yeah, absolutely. The world is everyone's reality is different, right? That each one of us have our own reality, and I view the world completely different to either of you. And it's up to us to, we can effectively shape and create that reality. And it's a matter of perception. Is it Marianne Williamson, which I think you quoted?
Yeah.
She obviously said a miracle is a change of perception from fear to love. Is that right? It's the same. It's hard to remember. I don't remember that a lot of the time, but I try, and if I'm having a tough day, not so OCD related, I'll try and think of that and think, how can I turn this? And what I'm scared of or angry or whatever it is into love, look at it differently.
And what I so appreciate about what you just said is it's personal responsibility. It's what can I do? And it all starts with our attitude, right? And we choose our attitude. It seems like, yeah, we have to see the world this way. No, we get to choose. And that's, I think, what Einstein was saying. And we discussed earlier this whole notion of greater good. That's a reaction or an option beyond the perceived good that our OCD doubt bullies would like to tell us. Our bullies say, you know, Jeff, checking your doors, that's a good thing to do. And I fought that for a long time and tried to say, no, that's a bad thing to do. And it was just this constant game. And it helped me so much when I was able to say, okay, there's a compelling case that doing my compulsions is a good thing to do, in quotes, but what's the greater good here? Mm-hmm. How do I instead choose something that allows me to be of service to somebody else or empower myself through a sense of purpose? And bringing it back to what you said, Stu, about just, you know, choosing the attitude, it's sort of like, I forgot that I get to make a choice here. We talked about Viktor Frankl. There's another fabulous quote that Stephen Covey worked with a lot in his work, which is, in between stimulus and response lies our power to choose. And in that power to choose lies our freedom. And the more we're able to remember that, we can choose not to do the compulsions. We can choose to do the ERP. We can choose to do the hard work. And that's been just revolutionizing for us in our lives with OCD.
Yeah, no, I love that that diagram by Stephen Covey that you just mentioned. It's the first time I actually saw it on... I'm familiar with Stephen Covey and his work, but I'd never actually seen that diagram before. And I thought that was a brilliant way of describing it. Another way that I've seen it in acceptance and commitment therapy is they call it the choice point. It's a little circle, and you've got an arrow away and an arrow towards. So when you're anxious and you've got that chance to compulse or stop it, you're at that choice point. You can either do the compulsion, but you're then going away from your goal, or you can hold off, not do it, and then you're going towards your goal. Mm-hmm. It's something that's very similar. I mean, if you go towards, your world expands. And obviously, OCD wants to shrink it constantly.
Yeah.
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 Cool. No, that's brilliant. And as you said, it's personal power. We all need to make the choice to not play victim. And I don't say that in a way to be mean to anyone, but it's on us to be that victor and be that champion because no one else can do it for us.
We sometimes say that our message is a tough love message because, I mean, I'm thinking about a seminar that I did once where somebody came up to me afterwards and they didn't demand their money back, but in so many words said, I'm really disappointed. And I said, oh, good, please give me the feedback because, I mean, this is helpful to me. What didn't work for you? He goes, I came here because I wanted you to make me more comfortable with my OCD. And I kind of smiled and did my best to explain to him that that's exactly opposite of what I try to do. I try to make people really uncomfortable with the OCD and help them find the motivation to do something about it. Because I'm the guy that spent years looking for the magic wand. I'd love to tell you it exists, but I haven't found it. And really, there's no way around the hard work, right? The ERP, the choice making, the constant vigilance. And so, yeah, it's sort of a tough love message that we put out there, but it works.
Exactly, of course. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Was it Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going.
Keep going.
And I love that. My mate always says, the only way out is through, which I always try and remember in tough times. Usually do with my workload. I have to use that quote. Okay, cool. Try and find the next question. We covered off loads here, which is brilliant.
Did you have any questions for the cats? Because we
Yes,
have
because
Murphy
the
here
other
now,
one
too.
is now coming up. So
Yeah, what's their favorite brand of cat food?
it's quite variable.
I was about to tell a joke. A comedian once said, I saw him in London, and he said, oh, I can't remember, I'm going to butcher it here. I don't, is there a cat food brand in America called Go Cat?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
It's a
I don't
brand in
think so.
England or the UK. It's called Go Cat. And he said something along the lines, he bought it for his cat. No, I can't remember. Basically, he said he thought the cat took it as a subliminal message and ran away. I ruined that, but I was in stitches for ages, and it wasn't even that funny. But okay, cool. So I think you said this, Jeff, in one of your talks. You said the only way to effectively manage uncertainty is to embrace uncertainty. You could sort of both go into that.
Sure. It's my Yoda-like impersonation. I call it the uncertainty paradox because it's certainly paradoxical. And the analogy that I found really helpful about explaining that or for explaining that is one that Dr. Tamara Chansky uses in a book called Freeing Your Child from OCD. And she did this great metaphors and analogies in the book. And one of them is when we're young, we get in a cold swimming pool. And the water's really cold, and our brains are shouting at us, get out, get out, get out, it's cold. But we're kids, and we splash around in the pool, and before long, the water warms up. Well, no, the water didn't warm up. What happened? We got used to it. And that at its core is what ERP is all about, right? Exposure therapy. We learn to habituate, as the clinicians would say, we learn to habituate to the anxiety. But those of us with OCD get this false belief that we can't handle that anxiety. So we keep getting out of the pool. And you know what happens when you get out of a cold pool and you get back into it? You never get that acclimation effect. You never get that warming up of the water effect. And so I think that sort of summarizes what's happening with the uncertainty paradox is really the only way to effectively navigate that uncertainty is to embrace it. You want to get comfortable in the cold water of anxiety? Stay in it. And we know through PET scans and other brain imaging techniques that if someone like me is put on a chair and is triggered somehow and prevented from doing any of my compulsions to try to reduce my anxiety, they're watching my brain and they're seeing the anxiety dissipate all on its own. It's medical fact. We know that. But it's so counterintuitive, and that's therein lies the paradox of the uncertainty paradox.
I think what's been most helpful for me around uncertainty is recognizing that that's really what life is all about is embracing uncertainty. I tell my clients that the overall goal of OCD treatment is to learn to live in a world of uncertainty and to be happy anyway. And when my OCD comes after me about some particular little thing that it's all twisted up about, and it wants certainty around that little thing, like, did you close the garage door? And it wants me to focus on that. What it helps me to do is step back and recognize it's all uncertain. Maybe I closed the garage door, but maybe it opened up 5 minutes later after I left. I don't know. So just this perspective of the entire world is uncertain. We have control over almost nothing. And if you're going to be happy, embracing that concept as much as possible is really important. So I think I always, what's helped me personally is just really understanding when OCD is trying to get me to go after this one little thing is to back it up and say, but it's all on. And accepting that to give me a lot of freedom.
Yeah, I like how you described that. And I think so many of us, I know I did, I just assumed that the rest of the world had the certainty that I was craving. That they, you know, totally got to know everything in their world was going to be okay. And I didn't. When in fact, the difference was they're no more certain than I am, but they process that uncertainty better and or in more healthy ways than I did. And that was a really key breakthrough, was coming to learn that, no, we did certain life isn't certain. There, you don't get that certainty that you crave. And so, yeah, it really is about just saying, I'm going to accept that. I'm going to embrace it. Bring it on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think as you were talking, something hit me. There was that if life was certain, it would be boring. And,
yes.
And you wouldn't want to live it.
No.
It's the uncertainty that gives life this meaning and purpose and joy. You know, if I knew exactly where I was going to be in 20 years, even if it was a good place, it would ruin the 20 years up to there because I wouldn't have any novelty, any surprise. I wouldn't have to work towards anything. So I think looking at it like that sometimes can be, well, actually uncertainty is a good thing. Certainty is the scary thing.
And you know, Stu, on that front, I think that what's helpful is to bring it all back to that notion of choosing to believe that the universe is friendly. Because if you accept that mindset, again, without any proof, but if you just choose, or you willfully choose to accept that the universe is friendly or to believe that, then you're able to let go of things and say, this doesn't make any sense to me, but I believe in some crazy way there's a bigger picture of this that I can't see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a brilliant point. I guess sometimes that's where having a faith comes into play. Mm-hmm. Unless you get religious OCD, then your faith's now counterproductive. But yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, cool. So we'll touch a bit more on ERP in a second. Something that I still struggle with OCD, I'm a million times better. It doesn't bother me as much anymore. But I still at times get days where I have sort of looming low levels of anxiety. It's like a constant drone in the background. I'm not spiking, but I would use the word unhappy to some extent. Mm-hmm. And there is intrusive thoughts, but they're faint as well. And I find that almost the hardest to shake because they're not attacking me where I can fully accept them. They're just constantly, occasionally tweaking. I just wanted to see if you guys ever experienced that and if there's any tips you have for anyone else dealing with that.
The first thing that comes to mind for me is just reminding myself that there are chemical or neurochemical components to OCD that are out of my control. We've talked about what is in my control and what is not in my control. I can choose not to do my compulsions. I can't choose not to feel anxious at times. And sometimes just making peace with that, accepting it, and reminding myself that this means nothing inherently in its own or in and of its own. Oh, sorry.
Having another cat issue with a Coke about to
come
to the computer.
I knew you. I could see you were trying to signal me for something. Because I think like a lot of us with OCD, so often I would try to assign meaning to what I was feeling, to work backwards. I'm feeling really anxious. I ran somebody over that I don't remember running over. And working with a therapist at some point along the way, I came to understand that sometimes anxiety is just anxiety. And it means no chemical reaction in my brain. And you know, for those days that you're talking about, where sometimes it seems like it's a little more intense than the usual baseline, there may be no reason behind that other than the chemistry between your ears. So.
That's a good point.
And Stu, I experienced the same thing that you're talking about for two different reasons. One, it might just be that I'm just anxious that day. And like Jeff was saying, there's actually nothing there, although my OCD tries to look for something to pin it on. But sometimes I'll also get what I consider to be my anxiety hangover. So if the day before I had a really big episode that took a lot of ERP to get through, I'll sort of have this lingering low level of anxiety that could go on for a little while afterwards. It just sort of free floats and stays there. And I consider that my anxiety hangover. But I remember it was recently I was having some sort of day where I woke up. It wasn't an anxiety hangover. It was just I was anxious. And I remember talking to you and saying, I'm feeling really anxious today. And Jeff said something. He goes, well, just remember that's just a feeling. It doesn't mean anything. And I think that was very helpful to me because I think this is where the mindfulness comes in, and we can say, well, gosh, just because I'm feeling like this doesn't mean, like you're saying, that there's anything actually there. And sometimes I'll even conceptualize it to myself as, okay, this is just the fight or flight response. It's just freaking out over nothing. It thinks there's a tiger here and it's not here. Almost trying to understand what's happening in my body physically that might be causing this to help me separate myself from it a little bit.
And this is when it's so helpful to have friends that understand this stuff, because it's really easy for me to point out to Shala that her anxiety is just anxiety, get
That's
over it. But when I'm having it, it's like, no, this mess means something. So it's funny how the rules are very different for other people than they are for ourselves sometimes.
No, absolutely. No, that's really helpful advice. Okay, so with ERP, I get a few people message me over the recent months and said, ERP doesn't work for me. I've tried it. Not that it doesn't work, it's too hard. It's usually the biggest complaint. They tried it once and it terrified them and they couldn't do it. And there's obviously a chance it's not going to work for everyone, but these people haven't done it for months and then given up. They've done it a few times and it's been too terrifying, or maybe their therapist has thrown them in the deep end when they shouldn't have. But is there any advice you have for those people, I guess?
I do. I think that one of the most important things that we can do before exposure therapy is we can change our relationship with anxiety. And this is something I learned from Reed Wilson, who was actually giving that very first presentation I saw at the ICDF conference all those years ago, is he was talking about that if we go into the exposure with the attitude of, I can handle my anxiety, I want to embrace uncertainty, and I want to embrace this anxiety because this is how I give my brain a learning experience. So I can get better. I think if people can shift their mindset so that they're looking at the anxiety as a really good thing. Like sometimes I will joke with my clients when I'm doing exposures with them, and I'll ask them what their SUDS level, their subjective units of distress scale level is on a 10-point scale, and they'll say it's at an 8, and I'll be like, "Is that awesome?" And they're like, "Uh-huh, that's awesome." I'll be like, "Would you like it to be a 9?" They're like, really like it to be a 9, because we're trying to work on this whole attitude of the anxiety can be something that's a signal that we're doing the right thing, that we're making the greater good choice, that we're sitting with the anxiety. And sometimes I think if people are so scared of the anxiety, which we all are because that's the way we're programmed, can make the ERP so hard. But if we can embrace it as a tool to use against the OCD, then I think it makes the exposure easier to approach.
Yeah, and I think I would only add to that. Excuse me, Milo.
These cats are like intrusive thoughts. Just
They are like intrusive thoughts.
that's
Oh
great.
my gosh.
Hey, Milo.
We're going to
Oh,
welcome them as part of
yeah.
the
Oh man, that's perfect. I love that. Now I can start thinking of my intrusive thoughts as Milo and Murph walking across
podcast.
campus. I think that we, as a community, professional and consumers, are coming to realize the value of motivation for this process. We're very fortunate in the OCD community to have a proven clinical approach that works. I mean, so many of the mental health challenges don't have that. ERP is a gold standard, but I think for a lot of years, the professional world didn't perhaps take seriously enough how key motivation is in this process. The process is only as good as a clinician's ability to keep you doing it, right? Mm. And I think for a lot of us, we just need to be reminded what's at stake with values-based, you mentioned ACT, for example, yeah. acceptance commitment therapy, greater good motivation techniques, values-based techniques. It's just, it's so difficult, this work that we're doing. We're being asked to sit with our very worst fears. I mean, that's tough work. We have to remember what's at stake. We have to remember that we want that anxiety, that there's a benefit to it. And we have to remember that we're capable of sitting with that anxiety. So I think that's sort of the next frontier for ERP is, you know, the motivational layer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I think maybe a lot of traditional therapists haven't ever learned or been exposed to the side of motivation, which obviously you guys have. And I think that's great. Maybe a step for OCD therapists is to become life coaches also. Maybe that could be the killer combination.
Yeah.
The platinum well, standard.
It really does help to have the bigger picture context, yes, though, right? I mean, if you look at ERP just as this tool thing, it you sort of lose where does it fit into the bigger picture of how you live your life, what your attitudes are, what your sense of faith and whatever that might be works out to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because something that dawns on me more and more at the minute is, you know, you can do ERP with someone and let's say you help them recover to a sort of very normal level, put normal in brackets. but they're still effectively got mental health issues in the form of, let's say it could be low confidence, low self-esteem, poor self-image. I'm trying to run out of things here. But you see what I'm getting at? And And I think we need to see that it's not just recovering from OCD, it's about creating an awesome life, you know, a life of, as you say, purpose and meaning. And that the goal should never be recovery from OCD, it should be living an incredible life. And part of that is recovery from OCD, but the goal should be more than OCD. But this, I don't feel this, I mean, you guys are focused on it, which is awesome, but there's not a lot of people that focus on that. And I'd love to see the, I don't want to use the word industry, you know, I'm getting it to go that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that Shala and I are recognizing more and more with the opportunity that we have to share these sorts of conversations with people about motivation and greater good choices and so forth is that ERP is sort of like this little microcosm of the larger picture of life. Isn't life all about making tough choices, choosing to forego the perceived good of relief through compulsions, through a greater good that allows us more meaning and value and service in our lives. And so we're sort of finding that those of us who have been through ERP are learning life lessons that go, as you say, Stu, far beyond recovering from OCD. Mm-hmm. And we like to think that there's a gift in that for, I mean, I like to assign some positive meaning to things that we've been through in life adversity. And it's like, there's a gift in here. We're learning through the gift of OCD to really be able to tackle some bigger picture issues that others might not be privy to learn about through the privilege of OCD.
Yeah.
I'm talking myself into that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's great. Stephen Hayes, when he was on the podcast, he said very much the same thing. He said, you know, if you have a mental health illness, you're the lucky ones because you've got a chance now to work on your brain to not only beat this illness, but to beat all these other mental health issues like confidence, mm-hmm. self-esteem, you know, past stuff that happened as a kid, let's say. Whereas most people will just go through life, they'd be too ashamed to see a therapist to talk about their issues. We've been forced to have to go in to see a therapist almost, and because of that, we're blessed to some extent.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But again,
a good reminder the next time you're having that day when you're really anxious.
Yeah.
Because it's harder to see the gift, right, when we're
absolutely.
To deal with the agony, but it's there.
Yeah. It's hard to be wise when you're in the trenches.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. No, that's really good. Sharla, you were in sales for 15 years, right?
Sales and marketing.
Sales and marketing. Yeah. So I mean, I've been in marketing now for 6-7 years, And I'm actually looking to retrain now. My path is not, I guess, it's whether I go down the psychology route around mental health, specifically OCD, or whether I go down the therapy route. So that's up in the air, but I know that I want to work around OCD and anxiety disorders. So I guess a question for you then is, what advice would you have for someone like me or someone who's looking to retrain into this field, from your experience?
Well, I think that's wonderful, first off, because we need so many more people to do this. And I
Absolutely.
think, Stu, with the fact that you have OCD, you understand it's a competitive advantage if you look at it from a marketing perspective, right?
Yeah. USP.
So I think, in terms of advice, it can be, I think, a little challenging to find higher education programs that have a CBT focus. And sometimes you might have to do a program that doesn't have that focus and create an independent study for yourself on the side while you're learning all the things that, might go into becoming a psychotherapist. It might not be totally focused on CBT. And that's what I did, was I sort of created this independent study track for myself, where I go to conferences and I created an independent study course for myself and started networking with people to try to learn that. And I think that was a little bit of a surprise for me. I assumed that when I went into school that there would be a course on CBT and we'd be learning how to do exposure. But in fact, that wasn't the case. And I became little Miss Exposure. So every time, anxiety disorders and OCD would come up in class, I'd be the one raising my hand saying, okay, now we're going to use exposure for this, right? And so that, I think, going into the field, the advice I would have is, don't be surprised if CBT and ERP aren't part of the program. But as an OCD advocate, you can bring a lot of knowledge to whatever program you're in. Just with your own personal experience and with one kind of work, you can educate everybody else right along with you, which is, I think, good.
Definitely.
And I think having a marketing background is really a good thing, because when I'm working with clients, I'm essentially trying to sell them on doing ERP. And so having that sales and marketing background, I think, has been really helpful to me, because it really is, from a therapist perspective, a sales job, because this is really
Oh,
tough.
yeah.
Yeah,
I
no,
remember
that's,
the.
yeah, sorry, go on.
I was just, I'm laughing to myself, thinking back on my earliest conversations with a therapist and my jaw dropping. And I'm thinking to myself, you want me to do what? And you want me to pay for that? So, yeah, I can see how the marketing part comes in.
Yeah, no, that's a really good observation. Yeah, thanks for that. That's helpful. The UK makes it really challenging to become a therapist, because CBT is seen as an extremely advanced form of therapy in the UK. So you have to train to be a psychotherapist first.
Oh, wow.
So that could take, 2 to 4 years, depending on where you go. You've then got to do another 2-year diploma in CBT. So that's 6 years. You can obviously be actually working during that time, but you won't be qualified, accredited. So I'm at the minute, my challenge is finding a way kind of around that. Not to cheat the system, but it's like, I understand OCD to an extent because I've lived with it the most of my life. There's not much more I can read about it than yeah. But yeah, there's a couple routes, so I'm figuring it out. And
Well, I
there's
think that's great, by the way. I'm really glad you're doing
a
that.
thank you, I appreciate it.
And there's a pretty amazing growing community in the States, at least, of folks like Shala who are doing what they're doing as clinicians because of what they've been through. And you've got this nice network growing of other therapists that you all support each other. And I love that. I mean, I think that's really cool, because I have so much respect for Shala and for you and hearing your ambitions there, because I know for you're talk about leaning into the anxiety. There are aspects of your work that inherently are going to challenge your OCD, right?
Yeah, and in fact, it's really funny. I have a fear of heights. And I was doing an exposure with a client on something like the London Eye, but a lot smaller. We have a very smaller, much smaller version of that in Atlanta. And So we were going to go on that because it was, you know, these little capsules that you sit in that are all glass around. And I was thinking, well, this would be great for her. And then we got on and we're going up. And I said, well, what's your suds level? And she said, I'm at a 5. And I was thinking to myself, well, that's awesome because I'm at an 8. Sometimes as a therapist, you'll get pushed in your own areas, which is, you know, it's good practice for me. It also gives me a lot of empathy with my clients, which, you know, you will have as well, because you know what they're experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It can also make for really good stories.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Did you share that with her?
I did not. I actually never share with my clients if anything is causing me anxiety, because I want to focus on them.
Yeah.
And that's where having my therapist support group. So I have a group of about 5 or 6 of us. We meet on the phone once a month and we talk about things that trigger us in all sorts of ways and sort of how we dealt with it as therapists and as people with OCD, and not just about getting triggered in session, but just getting triggered in life. Mm-hmm. And so that's the type of place I would take that. But I would never tell a client that I was feeling anxious about something like that, because I wouldn't want to turn it around to be about me. I always want it to be about them.
On the flip side of that, they do know that you have OCD.
Yeah.
And I've had the privilege of working with some of Shala's clients in groups. And your clients love you. And I think a big part of the reason that they love you is that you get them. And I'm thinking, you know, you'll find the same thing when you're doing the work, is you'll be able to empathize in ways that the best intentioned therapist with a lot of experience might not be able to. So I think that's great that you're doing that.
Cool. Yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate it. And the advice. Okay, cool. So it'd be good to explain to the audience, you know, what you're doing with Beyond the Doubt, what was the purpose behind it, and what you hope to achieve of it.
Sure. So I'm excited about this because when I published my second book in 2010, When in Doubt, Make Belief, I had some opportunities to share some of the principles about choosing greater good, about belief as an antidote to doubts, about some concrete steps we can take to get out of what I call the shadow of doubt. And I would hear from people who were using some of the tools in the book in their own clinical practices. And Shala was one of them. We had met, as she said, probably a year or two before at the IOCDF conference. But it just started a dialogue about how we might take some abstract concepts and make them concrete enough for people to use in very practical ways. And then it's been, what, about a year we've been working on this together? Mm-hmm.
Probably a little bit more.
A little bit more than that. And it's been great because we sort of hitched our advocacy wagons. We've both been doing advocacy on our own, and we realized that some of these core concepts were really at the center of both of our own interests in reaching out and hopefully helping people find some motivational tools. And so we built Beyond the Doubt, and we've just been having a blast. We've done some work in the corporate world, helping corporate America understand the lessons of OCD, if you will, the lessons of sitting with anxiety. We're doing some everyday anxiety workshops for people who don't have OCD but are dealing with the loss of a loved one or relationship issues and so forth. And then we're really drilling down within the OCD community and trying to provide some practical tools for people who are in ERP and therapists who want to employ some of these techniques.
We really think, as I think, Jeff, you mentioned earlier, that when you've gone through ERP therapy, you really do get to learn some things that it might take others a lifetime to learn, just because they haven't had the opportunity to face some of these extreme fears and to recognize the whole uncertainty paradox. So I think our overall goal is to really take the lessons that we've learned and help people learn how they can employ them on a day-to-day basis to live better lives, and to help people understand that they don't have to have an anxiety disorder to be able to use some of these skills and techniques, because everybody suffers from anxiety. And I think so many people end up making decisions based on fear and anxiety and not even knowing it. And what we want to help people do is recognize when they're acting based on fear, so they can do Viktor Frankl's, you know, stimulus response, have that freedom to choose.
Right. Yeah.
Because for as awful as OCD has been for, I mean, all of us, I mean, we've learned a lot from it And I think it's made me have a better life because it changed my perspective. And I think that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I really like the work you guys are doing beyond the doubt, as I said earlier. And you know, I went on the webinar, and it was brilliant. And I highly recommend anyone watching or listening to go and attend, or at least check it out and see if it's for them.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, yeah, awesome. Keep it up. And okay, so what's that? Here's a question for both of you. You meet someone, let's say it's like the elevator pitch. So you meet them, you've got only 30 seconds of them, you're never going to see them again, and you know they've got OCD. What do you say to them?
Oh gosh, Sean?
That's all I have time to think, right?
Yeah.
So I think I would say to them that I can empathize with them because OCD can be highly debilitating, it's devastating. But the biggest thing they should know is that they need to have hope, that we have really good treatment and they can take their lives back from the disorder. It is very treatable.
And I would probably add to that in the remaining 30 seconds of our elevator trip. You are not your doubts and your fears. You are not your doubts and your fears. And the antidote to doubt is belief. And you can learn to systematically make belief over and over again. In ways that empower you to see past your doubts and your fears.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, no, that was brilliant. Both brilliant answers. I actually love asking that question. Because when you don't give people time to think, you get such an authentic answer. Okay, cool. So similar. It doesn't have to be OCD related, but you've got a billboard, let's say one in San Francisco, one in Atlanta. I was going to say downtown Atlanta, but I don't know if that's a thing.
It is a thing.
Okay, good. So you can have anything written on it. Doesn't have to be OCD related. Can if you want. What's that thing you write on the billboard?
That one I can answer right off the top.
You go first.
Okay. Mine would be dare to believe beyond your doubts.
Good.
So mine would probably have nothing to do with OCD. Mine would probably say something like, let the car that's trying to get ahead of you, over. Let's all back up a little bit and make room for everybody. Because I think that, number one, that's a little pet peeve of mine.
Yes, yeah, I've noticed.
Yeah, he's driven with me and he's heard this. But also, I think it's just a good metaphor for life is that look out for the other guy. Look and see where you can actually grease the skids to make somebody's life easier. Mm. Because I think we can all make a positive impact on each other in small ways that we may not even recognize.
That's good. I like that.
That'd be my billboard.
Do you know what? I don't think many people would get the deeper meaning behind that if they read it. They would
probably
take it
not.
Literally. Yeah, but that's really good. I like that.
But then they might let me over in traffic, though, and that would be okay as
well.
Yeah. So since I make my living as an interviewer, I can't help but turn the tables and say, tell us about your billboard, Stu.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I answered this a few episodes ago, and I can't remember what I said. It might have been Let It Be by the sort of the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
But I
that
don't know.
That plays big in Liverpool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I want to change it up. I don't know what. No, do you know what? I don't know. Oh. Oh, I'll go with Marianne Williamson, which is "You Are Powerful Beyond Measure."
Yeah. I like that one.
Which I actually have tattooed on my back.
For real?
I have that whole quote, minus the bit about God. Not because I have anything against God, but because when I originally saw that, I saw it in the film Coach Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they quote it, but they, for some reason, I guess to make it more commercial, removed the God part. And that's what I got on my back.
I love it. I'm a big fan of Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
That's good to hear. Yeah.
Cool. She was on London Real, which is a podcast, I don't know if you ever heard of. Here in London, obviously, but they interview some of the greatest minds around the world, and she was on it recently. It was a great, great interview. I won't plug that podcast anymore. But cool. I mean, how can people find out more about you, take part in your webinars, and anything else you're doing?
Sure. So they can go to beyondthedoubt.com.
Yep.
If people are interested in taking part in their webinars, there's a list, there's a menu at the very top that says next event at the end. Just click on that, and it always has a list of when the next webinar is that people could sign up there.
And we are building a collection, which we'll go ahead and say will be the world's largest collection
That's right.
of hazard signs. And so if people would like to contribute to that, we would welcome their input as well, because we have a lot of fun talking about the fact that we choose to believe that the universe is friendly, despite all of the signs literally around us that would suggest otherwise. And we've been collecting our favorite hazard signs, all the things that could go wrong around you. So
Yes.
that's at the website as well.
Yeah, and that's a genius idea. And you used a lot of those in your presentation, right?
Yeah,
Yeah, those are a lot of fun to talk about.
It got me thinking from like a like I guess America and UK. From the British point of view, we see America as a very big sort of lawsuit and suing culture. Whether that's true or not, it could just
It's
be,
true.
yeah, okay. I didn't want to necessarily believe the media. So like the one where you opened your window, I think it was in your house, Charlotte, and it had the warning about, it could cause injury if you jump out, and it was on the ground floor. And I was like, you'd never see that in the UK, and it's almost the window maker's absolutely terrified of being sued. So they're it's obviously not good for OCD when you're surrounded by warnings.
Well, I actually have a funny story about that. I lived in London, believe it or not, about 15 years ago, and I like riding horses. And so I would ride the horses in, I believe it's Hyde Park. And the very first time I went to go ride, I was, signing up everything. And I said, well, where's the paperwork I need to sign? Because in the US, to ride a horse, you have to basically sign your life away. I'm like, well, where's all the paperwork? And they're like, oh, we don't do any of that paperwork. I know you do all that in the US. Just get on the horse. Okay. And I didn't. It was awesome. And I didn't fall off and nothing happened. So I've always remembered that. I think that's funny.
No, we're quite good like
I think
that.
so too.
All right, brilliant. I've really enjoyed this conversation on a personal level, and also I think we got lots out of this, and anyone listening or watching is going to be better for it. So thank you, and keep up the work, guys.
Thank you so
Right
much.
back at you, Stuart. We poked around your website and love the collection of wonderful videos you're building and your commitment to helping people find inspiration. So thank you for
Cheers.
what you're doing.
Nice pleasure. Thank you. But definitely, we'll do this again sometime.
Sounds good.
Sounds great.
Okay.
All right, have a good Friday.
Thanks,
Cheers.
you too.
Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.